T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Day, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Thanks for joining us for today's podcast titled Coronavirus Facts Only. Every day around midday, I'll talk with a doctor about COVID-19 and how we're getting through this crisis and change of lifestyle. Let's welcome once again Dr. Fred Buchhold. Dr. Buchhold is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. He's also the co-host with me of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health every Saturday afternoon at 4 o'clock on KMOX. Dr. Buchhold, thanks for joining us again.
Happy to do so.
Since we last talked, we've had the first death in the city of St. Louis due to COVID-19, a woman in her 30s. What's the message here?
Well, this is an equal opportunity infector, and you know, everybody is vulnerable. We're starting to see more cases, I guess, in the U.S. as this has kind of ransacked our country, is that a number of younger people are affected, which has gone against the conventional wisdom that's in press reports. But, you know, this was happening, you know, since the onset of this. You know, the numbers are subject to change because the type of people infected in China is, you know, was slightly different than the U.S. Still has a little bit better nutrition and just a different set of conditions than what was in China. So this is going to rapidly evolve, but I think it just shows we're all at risk. And young people as well too. And my heart goes out to the family of this individual who passed. And sadly, I don't think it's going to be the last. I think this is something that should get all of our attention. We're not immune or invulnerable just because we're younger or healthy. This can happen to anybody.
St. Charles and Jefferson counties have now joined St. Louis City and St. Louis County with stay-at-home orders. Again, remind us what this essentially means.
So essentially stay at home unless you absolutely have to. So, you know, the exceptions to this are, you know, getting groceries or prescriptions at a grocery or pharmacy, to some degree, exercise or being outside in public parks. But again, the idea, as much as possible, social distance. So stay as far away from other people as possible, you know, at least at 6 foot minimum, and then frequent hand washing with that. But that's, you know, if it is not vital or urgent, do not go out, is essentially the intention of this. And the power of this, or why, you know, it's thought to be effective, is basically it just keeps these kind of critical concentration of human beings that may or may not have this and may or may not have symptoms from basically contaminating each other. So it's just to limit the opportunities for this virus to spread from person to person.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has ordered all hospitals in his state to increase capacity by 50%. Is that realistic? A good idea? You think you could do it at SLU?
Well, at SLU, yes. We're kind of in a unique situation of, you know, we have a brand new hospital that's about to open, you know, literally next door. And you know, that conversation has, you know, been occurring. I'm not privy to those conversations, but I know that's been discussed. We had a capacity add. I believe we have some kind of, we call it the MASH tent, but I don't know really what it is, but it's a way to expand capacity. It's really designed for, or it's supposed to be there for, you know, massive emergencies, which of course this is. I think on a bigger systemic level, I mean, we've seen a chronic disinvestment in our healthcare facilities generally, and the number of hospitals across the country are closed. The policies of healthcare in the United States have been tenuous and very ambiguous in the last couple of years, which has been troubling. And many people have talked about this, about, you know, these systemic risk issues. You just can't wish a 50% capacity for a place like New York, where there's you know, it's such a dense area and there's a lot of occupancy. I don't know where you find the physical space for that. Never mind, you know, the staff to do it. You know, we've talked about this even at our facility. If even as we, you know, we can magically make 100 extra ICU beds, who's going to staff that? Who are the providers, the physicians and the physician extenders, the nurses, respiratory therapists, all the people it takes to staff that up, you know, aren't there. So you just can't magically hope for this. And to train a professional takes time. We've already had a shortage of professionals in this country for some time and, you know, lack of clear policies to guide that. This is just kind of all these chickens coming home to roost. But you just can't, just like you can't magically have extra hospital beds, you can't magically make more medical equipment, which is a massive, massive, massive problem right now. We can't magically make more tests. It takes time to bring those up. And the lack of preparation we're getting paid or getting punished for as a society. So you can order anything you want. The operationalizing that and making it happen is a whole other issue that's very, very complicated. Just by sheer luck, we're in a little bit better situation than others, but it's you know, there's still a lot of things that have to go into play for that. And it's a very difficult thing to solve, kind of in the midst of trying to deal with another whole other number of fires we're trying to deal with as well. It's a compounded problem. I think it's not realistic, short answer.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, what's the latest you're hearing about the medical supply shortages in this area?
Well, I think we're already acutely dealing with that. We're trying to figure out, we're trying to limit the amount of people that go in and see patients that have any kind of, are under any kind of isolation. Bear in mind, before COVID, you know, we were dealing with flu, and we have people with lots of other infections that we have to wear personal protective equipment for, either to protect ourselves or to prevent the spread to other patients. So, you know, we still have those patients, and, you know, really it's just about limiting the amount of times people go in. You know, a big issue with when you wear this equipment is actually patients get less care because it takes time to kind of put on all this equipment. And now that we're trying to limit and resource it, that means we're trying to limit the amount of times we go in the room and check on a patient, which is, you know, against everything we're trained and want to do. So, you know, but you're trying to be very cognizant of that and put things in place to limit that. But there's downstream effects to all that as well. But, you know, we want to order more. We would like to have more. Everybody wants more, and the supplies are dwindling. That's it's a very real threat, and it's caused a lot of angst amongst my group. Probably the bulk of my day yesterday was talking about that, about what to do, you know, what if scenarios, and what do we do? Should we not have the protection we need? That's a very disturbing thing to think about. If you're a provider, you want to take care of patients, but your life is on the line and you're exposed. And, you know, we don't want to die either. So it's a very real threat. It was an existential threat a couple weeks ago, and now it's really hitting us. And that's caused, it's difficult to navigate through that. I'll just put it that way.
Researchers now say the loss of smell could be a hidden symptom of coronavirus. What are you hearing?
Yeah, I think that's kind of come up multiple times. And I think the fascinating thing here is, you know, there's a lot of discussion and social media has been amazing for this, about kind of in real time getting information about as this disease evolves or knowledge evolves around this. I think really everything is on the table. And, you know, I think the threshold for at least being concerned you have this is getting lower and lower as this starts to spread through our communities. And, you know, again, the one positive thing about this is, one is I think a lot of people will have very, symptoms that probably won't lead to this severe disease, which is I hate to say the word good, but it's just, you know, that's a little bit reassuring. But I think the other thing is just anything where you're not feeling right or you have a question kind of warrants that discussion of just if all that fails or you're unsure and you're not sick, just stay the heck away from everybody else. And that's the first thing, because we don't have the testing available to test you. But if you notice these things are unusual or you just feel off, you know, you should be at home anyway at this point if you're living in the region, and just continue to stay at home and avoid others. And that without the ability to test people kind of on a large scale, which we need to get to yesterday, that's the best way. And if this is a symptom, it's popping up and people have said it, I think it's worth paying attention to. And I guess the last thing about this is what we're finding, other than kind of, pretty predictably, people with at least disease that presents clinically, they typically have fever. So fever is kind of the one kind of equalizer amongst at least people that present to healthcare. There's probably people at home that don't have fevers, but fever is probably the most kind of dominant symptom that occurs for most people that have COVID. But with everything else, the symptoms appear in 10 to 20 to 30% of people. So, runny nose, sore throat, sneezing, all these kind of occur kind of at variable rates. And so if there's other symptoms that, if we haven't asked for them, but people are noticing, it very well could be. And I think it's worth paying attention to. And this has all been discussed on social media, which is kind of interesting. It's been a great way to get information so far, not only for you as an individual, but for us as providers, just to see what's working with others. This whole idea of we've kind of learned not to, when people have respiratory problems, that we just kind of go straight to intubation, putting people on a machine rather than do some of the other stuff we do, because that may spread or make the disease worse. And so that's all kind of gleaned from just talking to each other on social media, which has been pretty phenomenal to do.
Dr. Buchholz, why does COVID-19 cause shortness of breath?
So it affects the lungs. So in that subset of people that have respiratory symptoms and get fairly sick and the kind of a fatal form of this disease is the chemical break that doctors use between what we call upper respiratory symptoms and lower respiratory symptoms. And the traditional thing is just kind of your voice box, which is kind of right in your middle of the neck. For males, it's right where your Adam's apple is, or right near your Adam's apple. And basically lower respiratory symptoms or anything below that. So basically the lungs and what we call the bronchioles, which supply your lungs. And the disease causes enough of a reaction and response in the lungs in these severe cases that, basically the lungs lose their ability to exchange oxygen, which is their primary function. And in those patients, it can get, some people will just need some oxygen and just need some supportive care. Others really need us to intervene and basically use the machine to breathe for them. But if enough of the lung is damaged that we can't, the machine, we can't deliver enough oxygen to sustain life, these are the people that ultimately succumb to this. And that's, that's just kind of the reaction the lungs have to this infection. I'm not entirely clear. I've been kind of reading up on this, and it's probably a mix of both. It's either the virus that does this itself or the body's response to the virus that does it. It can happen both ways in most patients for other diseases. I suspect the same is here. We still don't know that yet. Either way, the treatment's really the same. But it's just we try to do our best and throw everything we have at these patients. And even still, we're not perfect and medicine's not perfect. And, this is where people unfortunately pass.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. I want to run some listener questions by you. The first one has to deal with the breathing situation. A listener asked me that she saw an internet story suggesting if you can't hold your breath for a certain amount of time, you could have COVID-19. Any truth to that?
Not really. I think the question is, for instance, I can hold my breath for a certain amount of time. I haven't done that since I was a kid to time myself and how long I could do that. What you're looking for is a change. So if I hold my breath for a minute and then now you can't hold it for more than 20 seconds, sure, that might be suggestive of something. But again, our own biases and our psychology plays a role in this. I think it's really more, just kind of knowing your physical activity during your normal day. If you can walk up a flight of stairs or run up a flight of stairs without any problem whatsoever, and now when you walk up, you can barely make it halfway without having to stop and catch your breath, that's a change, at least get your attention. So it's a change in your ability to do things without that feeling of breathlessness or with a feeling of breathlessness. So that can manifest in almost any way. The question I always ask is just basically, if you go down to the basement and you walk back up, are you able to do that without any trouble? You shouldn't be out at a grocery store unless you have to, but if you walk around a grocery store, but if you feel more short of breath or have some problems with that, those will be kind of those little signs. But you know, really where we worry about people is when they're at rest or with very, very minimal exertion, when they just can't catch their breath and they're really struggling just to breathe normally. That's where, again, in this situation, seeking medical attention is I think, important.
Another question from a listener. She says she sees people spitting on the ground all the time. Shouldn't that be totally discouraged now? Is there some sort of outdoor etiquette we should adhere to?
Well, I think spitting on the ground, period, is a breach of etiquette. I guess that my mom would always tell me that. So, that's gross. Don't do that anyway, particularly in public areas, although right now we should not be in public areas. We should be spitting anyway. Again, anything that comes out of your mouth, particularly if you have this disease, even if you don't have symptoms, that just assume that has virus in it. So, when you spit, even though, the vast majority of that should hit the ground, there's still the opportunity for aerosolization or small water particles to become part of the air, and that's part of the contagion. So, yeah, just keep stuff in your mouth. When it has to come out, cover it up properly, Kleenex, handkerchief, your sleeve, whatever it takes. Just make sure to wash the material afterwards or throw it away.
Yeah, and that actually brings us to the next question I have from a listener. She says sneezing into your sleeve doesn't seem too sanitary. Shouldn't a tissue be the preferred method, or what about a handkerchief?
Yeah, I think a tissue is. I mean, basically, you're right. When you sneeze in any kind of piece of material, you now just, what you're doing is just transferring that material from your mouth. You've got to sneeze, so it's not like you can control that. What you're trying to do is prevent the aerosolization or the small particles kind of going out into the air, and that's what infects other people. So, sneezing without covering is the worst. Sneezing your hand is okay. You just need to make sure to wash your hands thoroughly afterwards. Sneezing in your sleeve is okay. It's not the greatest, but you just want to make sure to change your clothes and wash the material as quickly as you can. Same thing with a handkerchief. The problem with handkerchiefs is just you're sneezing repeatedly into the same thing. So maybe, some of the virus may be getting back in your system. And I don't know what the effect of that is one way or the other, but that's not preferable. I think sneezing in a tissue is fantastic, and you make sure to throw the tissue away immediately afterwards. That's probably the best effect. And then, just with all that, no matter what, just wash your hands thoroughly afterwards. Soap and water, preferably. Aqua wipe if that's more available to you. But make sure to get rid of as much content as possible.
Another social distancing question for you, Dr. Buchhold. A listener wants to know, should you keep 6 feet of separation from people in your own home, like your spouse?
Well, I think the answer to that depends. So, if you've been in close contact and if you don't know you've had it and you're now in kind of isolation, it probably doesn't, at that point, I think you're going to get, if you've gotten it, your significant other or your family might have gotten it too. So again, you see these cases where, that terrible story about that family in New Jersey where they spread it all amongst themselves and they've had a number of people pass from that family. But there's an article in the paper this morning about that family, I think, out in West County where the same thing, they just kind of spread it amongst themselves. At that point, the horse is already out of the barn. You're whether or not you're distancing or not is kind of a mute point, although I think in that family, they knew that some of the family members did not have it, did not test positive, and a couple did, so they separated themselves. And I think that's where it's important. So one person has symptoms and everybody else feels fine, I would recommend separation. In my own case, I'm a physician. I think the odds are quite high I'm going to get this. I don't think I've had it yet, although I don't really know. But I imagine, I'm not yet, but I soon will be taking care of patients in the hospital. The question I'm having for myself is, when I come home, do I self-quarantine or, even get, stay in another facility like a hotel or something like that? That's a real consideration for me. And certainly when I've been out and even over the weekend when I, was kind of stocked up on groceries, when I came home, I changed my clothes immediately, put those in the washer, made sure not to touch anything. I changed my clothes just right as we got in the door. So that way, I'm trying to reduce those contamination if it's there at all. But I think if people have symptoms or one person tests positive or has a suspicion, they have not been in contact with others, including their family, that quarantine away makes a lot of sense. But if you've been together and none of you have symptoms, if you haven't done it yet, you've probably transmitted it or you don't have it. so it doesn't make sense. So short answer, it depends.
One more question for you from a listener. He says every year there's a different strain of flu out there. Could that be the same case next year with COVID-20? Would a possible COVID-19 vaccine work against COVID-20?
That's a great question. The short answer is nobody knows. You know, when we develop vaccines, just like the flu vaccine, why you have to get it every year is two things. One is we developed a vaccine that can make a pretty predictable immune response to some of the proteins on the flu, but those are proteins that change every year. Now, the flu's got some things that are what we call conserved, meaning that some very typical things that are in every flu virus, but so far it tends to make a vaccine that kind of thin those off, have not been successful. And so the question is, you can make a virus or a vaccine, I should say, to this particular virus and something that it expresses, or it's on this virus only, that may not be universal or conserved with other coronaviruses. So time's going to tell with that. And again, I think when we first started talking about this, I mean, the problem with coronavirus is just for the majority of people, traditionally, it causes a cold and that's it. So the money and the wherewithal to develop a vaccine, which is traditionally pretty expensive, just wasn't there because, you know, everybody gets colds and just kind of, it's not the coronavirus, it's a number of different viruses. But, you know, this has had such a huge effect, you know, it probably is going to change the research agenda for, you know, the National Institutes of Health, which is a big driver of research in the United States and fund research because it's important to discover new things. You know, our problem, and this is a universal human problem, is we always fight the last war, right? So, like, we're all worried about COVID-19 now. Could COVID-20 come? There, you know, another novel coronavirus? Sure. Would it have the same effect? We don't know. But we may have something totally different that's out there and may just kind of run havoc through us as well. You know, it might be, you know, some totally different virus or something else. I don't know. This is why we have to conduct research to just say, so we can have knowledge about how to deal with these all differently and be more nimble in dealing with this. Our big problem right now has been, it's not just how novel this is and how, you know, easily it's spread and contaminated, but, you know, we've been behind and not been proactive in dealing with this because, the expertise wasn't listened to. And to be fair, it's hard to know when to pull that trigger. And, you know, I think when I first talked about this, I wasn't too concerned, and you can probably find this. And then that switch flipped about 3-4 weeks ago for me. And, you know, but I think it takes these discussions and being prepared and having people who are experts dealing with this to say when to really get concerned and get ready for this. And you know, that requires funding, it requires money, but it's a good return on investment. And, you know, this is, we need to fund research for vaccines for these types of things, but also the public health measures, which really is what's going to save our bacon the next time this occurs. Because the next thing that occurs, we will not have a vaccine for either, I guarantee it. And it's public health and all these other things are vitally important that we got to fund, not for when things are good, but when things are bad, like it is now. And we're being punished for that as a society.
Dr. Buckle, thanks so much for your time again today. Really do appreciate it.
No, and I appreciate the questions, Fred. They're great. Really good questions. So keep them coming. I like answering them.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU Care General Internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. He's also the co-host with me of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health, airing every Saturday afternoon on KMOX at 4 p.m. So please come back again tomorrow to KMOX.com and check out our latest podcast titled Coronavirus Facts Only. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Thanks for joining us.